You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Since the mid-1990s, the number of international adoptions by foreigners has climbed to nearly 40,000 per year. But there is more to the process than many adoption agencies would have you believe. E.J. Graff, Associate Director and Senior Researcher at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, recently completed a one-year study investigating the world of international adoptions. And E.J. Graff joins me now to discuss some of the shocking things she's uncovered during her research. Welcome to our show.
It's an honor to be with you.
You say that the belief that there are millions of orphan babies all around the globe in desperate need of loving homes is a myth. What about all those photographs of overwhelmed orphanages that I've seen in developing countries like Vietnam and Guatemala?
Well, I wonder if I could start just by saying that what we found, people can get a little bit defensive when I start talking about the problems in international adoption. And I want to say that the families that adopt and the children who are adopted are innocents. As far as I can tell, everyone goes into international adoption with loving and humanitarian and large-hearted hopes, and I hope that all their families are happy and wonderful. No one goes into international adoption in order to steal a baby. However, there is this number that UNICEF has put out, 132 million orphans or 143 million orphans, depending on the year, which number they're putting out. I'm sorry, I hear an echo on the line. If it's possible for someone to deal with that.
It sounds okay to us here on the air.
Okay, all right. But that number includes children who are not actually orphans. It includes children who are, sorry, it's very distracting for me to hear myself, who have lost just one parent. It includes children who have lost both parents but are living with their extended families. And it includes children who are, in some cases, temporarily in an institution while their families have put them there to bring in the harvest, or essentially as a boarding school or a child care institution for temporary purposes. And when children are in need of a new family, they are almost always older than five, sick, disabled in some way, or in other ways, hard to place.
The same sorts of things that we see in U.S. adoptions, isn't it? The same problem here?
It's very similar. The myth is that those millions of, quote-unquote, millions of orphans are healthy infants. And just about nowhere in the world, with possible exception of China, are healthy infants abandoned. Orphans are almost never healthy babies, and healthy babies are almost never orphaned.
And you say that the demand is far greater than the supply. So is that why some babies are being acquired by illegal means?
There's an enormous amount of money that goes into international adoption. Again, as I say, the families do not say, here's $20,000 so you can go buy a baby for me overseas. But there are many steps between the adoption agency and the West, and it's not just from the U.S. by any means. There's many steps between giving money to an adoption agency in the U.S. and the child being acquired at the other end. It's like a lot of kinds of globalization. The organization in the West can plausibly deny that they know what's going on the other end. But they hand their money over to a facilitator in Vietnam or Cambodia or Guatemala, or Ethiopia is starting to look a tiny bit dicey, or Nepal, and that facilitator might call themselves a orphanage director or a maternity home director or some other title, and then they hand over $1,000 or $600 or something that's equivalent to a year's income in the local economy to a child finder, who might be a police officer or a nurse or somebody else who could certainly use the money and who knows where there are vulnerable people, vulnerable women, who would be able to relinquish a child if coerced or if might not be able to resist $60 and a bag of rice to support the rest of their family, or just might be able to have a child kidnapped from them.
Is there this sudden boom in demand for foreign babies doubled since the mid-1990s?
I think there's two reasons for that. One is there's an assumption that domestic adoption in the United States is really troublesome, that birth parents want to take their children back. I haven't looked into this in depth, but I have been told that that impression is greatly exaggerated, that there have been one or two high-profile cases and that it's not really true. But I believe there's also an impression that children, infants, babies from overseas a little more are blank slates, and that they are in desperate need, that because of the extreme poverty that we can see on television or in newspaper photos, that families are just abandoning their babies right and left, and those babies desperately need someplace. And people have big hearts. They want to bring those children home. China also has given people the wrong impression. There, while I have certainly heard some credible reports of baby buying and baby stealing, and while China has arrested something more than 20 officials for one of those scandals, for the most part, it appears that China's one-child policy has led to a lot of abandoned girls. And I think those children coming over to the United States and to other Western countries has given people the impression that that's happening worldwide, that there's abandoned children worldwide.
In the case of China, girls are not generally valued as highly as boy babies. Is that another reason for that kind of trade coming out of China in such large numbers?
I am told that there's an increased demand for domestic adoption in China. There's been quite a heated discussion about whether those internationally adopted Chinese girls are in fact in need of international adoption, or if the Chinese orphanage directors have figured out that they can get more money from international adopters than they can from domestic adopters. I'm not sure if that's true.
To what extent have celebrities like Mia Farrow, Angelina Jolie, and Madonna influenced the popularity of this approach? When they adopt so many kids, it gives the impression that there are worthy infants that need to be saved.
Absolutely. You're the first one I've talked to who's mentioned Mia Farrow. You must be as old as I am.
She's the only one of the three that I've met, actually. We've talked about Darfur quite a bit and Congo as well.
Yes, Angelina Jolie in particular has been blamed or honored for bringing attention to adoption as something that's supposed to be humanitarian. I'm not sure that the best way to take care of needy children in underdeveloped countries is by adopting the 1 or 2 or 10,000 that Americans might be able to adopt. What the aid agencies say, the people who are on the ground really trying to repair communities so that they can support their children, is that other things are needed much more. Money for water, money for schools, money for social services that enable people to care for their children when someone in the family is ill.
More recently, Angelina Jolie has adopted babies from Africa, but aren't Asian babies more popular in the international market? How important is race in this practice?
That's a really interesting question. I have Africa. Several of the most popular countries have been shut down recently for two reasons. One is China has restricted how many children it will allow international families to adopt. They've tightened the number, and this might be because of their increased prosperity. That's one of the theories. And with that, families have been looking to some of the other popular countries, but some of those other countries have been shut down because of widely documented corruption. Guatemala, Vietnam, Cambodia. Nepal was briefly shut down and is about to reopen, although the signs about that country's program are not very good, I am told. Ethiopia is currently the popular country, the country where numbers are rising in terms of how many people are applying to adopt from there. And I do find that very interesting, that Westerners are willing to adopt children with African ancestry more from another country than they are from the United States. I don't have an answer to why that is.
In the case of Russia, there was a national pride played a part in cutting down the the number of adoptions. And wasn't there a scandal recently in Chad when a French NGO claimed that it had rescued orphans who weren't really orphans?
Yes, the Zoe's Ark scandal. They were pretty obvious about it. They simply stole children. They just took children. They said they were trying to rescue them, and they were trying to bring home children for French families to adopt. The French have a long list of families that want to adopt.
So this is not just an American thing?
Oh, no. Spain, Italy, Ireland. Italy tends to be to remain in countries that other countries have closed because of corruption. Spain has had some of the children from Nepal that birth families have been asking for their children back, and they're in Spain. But what I was going to say about Africa is that while Chad really made a big splash in the news, a lot of the African countries have a lot of corruption in their adoption programs. Liberia has gotten a lot of play in the BBC. It's almost counterintuitive, but if a country is war-torn and poor, it's probably not a good country to adopt from, because there are going to be unscrupulous people who will try and take advantage of Western money and Western humanitarian hopes by illicitly acquiring children and selling them.
My guest is E.J. Graff, Associate Director and Senior Researcher at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. She's recently completed a one-year study investigating the world of international adoptions. So let's talk about how this process works. Who acquires the babies that are subsequently adopted by foreigners?
You are talking about in whatever the poor country might be.
Yeah.
It's slightly different in each country, but the general outline is that there is a local facilitator, usually someone from the middle classes, who figures out that they can sell the children, and I'm going to say this really crassly, which is never how people want to think about it. They can acquire the children of the poor and sell them to rich Westerners.
Now, are they working as private entrepreneurs, or are they being hired by international adoption networks to do this as brokers?
They get their money from Western adoption agencies. They are paid per child. Let me also clarify, I'm not saying that every child who has been internationally adopted has been stolen. I am focused on when it goes wrong.
And when you say stolen, what do you mean stolen? Do they actually go into a home and take the baby, or does money pass hands?
It varies. The child can be purchased, defrauded or coerced away from the birth family, or flatly kidnapped. All three of those have been documented. And when it's purchased, I've had people say to me, well, why, if some poor woman in Guatemala or Vietnam or Ethiopia decides that her child's going to have a better life in the United States, and meanwhile she can feed her other children with the money she'll get for that child, why shouldn't she be free to sell her child? And I don't have an opinion on that. If we want to use other countries as sources of surrogacy, well, then let's have that discussion. But let's not say it's a purely humanitarian adoption. And let's make sure that they have the kind of regulatory protections that Western mothers would have, or Western families would have. In some cases, they're making a Sophie's choice. I will sell this baby in order to be able to feed the rest of my family. And that, there should be some other form of aid, I believe.
Now,
in other cases, they are genuinely lied to. They are told, drop your child off at this institution and we'll feed her for a couple of years and then you'll be able to see her again. Or here's $50 of humanitarian assistance and drop your child off at our institution and some American will take care of her and then she'll come back when she's 12. And in some cases, they give birth and are told by the doctors, your child's deathly ill and here's a $1,000 medical bill and you can't even see him again until you pay it. And of course, $1,000 is 10 times her income. So that child goes to some Spanish or Italian or Irish or American family, and there's relinquishment papers signed by an illiterate person, or they're fraudulent papers. There's a variety of ways this can happen.
And this all sounds rather shady, so I'd assume that no respectable organizations are involved in this sort of thing.
I love your optimism. I don't know how you define a respectable organization. I would like to believe that every high-minded adoption agency makes sure this doesn't happen on the other end, but I'm not certain that that's the case.
So if well-known agencies are getting away with this, how does that happen without advocacy groups taking notice? Because this is not something that has been talked about a lot. Your study, in fact, seems to have uncovered all sorts of new information.
This has been this problem has been discovered and documented deeply in a variety of countries, but the documentation tends to be very local. So Guatemalan human rights groups, for instance, and newspapers have in-depth documentation of what's gone wrong in Guatemala. Or in Cambodia, the Phnom Penh Post did a spectacular investigative series where they traced back the coercion, fraud, baby buying, government payoffs before the United States closed that country to American adoption. In the Nepali Times has had spectacular articles. But how many Parisians or New Yorkers are reading the Nepali Times before they go to adopt from Nepal? So what we were able to do was take that primary documentation from a variety of human rights groups or newspapers and put it together and see how this works, as I said before, as any other globalization system does. When one country changes its regulations or shuts down to this trade, the trade finds another unregulated, poor or corrupt country that can be exploited.
The
money goes there.
What are the adopting parents told by these agencies? Surely no one wants to adopt a child who'd been kidnapped. Are they told that only given the most rosy scenarios?
They're told a variety of things. Again, I'm giving the really general overview, and anyone who would like to see the details, the documentation behind this abstraction is really welcome to come to our website and see all those reports and news accounts that I have. That's at www.brandeis.edu/investigate. So what are the parents told? It depends on the case, but they might get documents that say your child was abandoned, and they're simply fraudulent documents that were bribed out of an official, or they might get actual information about the birth family, but they're not told that someone went out soliciting the child and that the child would have been raised by the family had no one come and offered them $50 and told them that the child would come back when they were 18.
How much profit is there in this business? How much are parents paying for some of these babies?
Well, parents are just doing spectacular things in order to come up with the money. I mean, people that want to have larger families or families for the first time will really put themselves out on the edge in order to afford it. Some people take out a second mortgage. Some people have the extra $20,000 or have saved it up. Some people hold fundraisers. The kind of investigation that I've done is very hard for some of these families to hear. Nobody wants to believe that they might have accidentally waded into an illicit trade.
Go ahead.
No. I mean, especially if they really, they really want to do something good. And again, I'm not saying that this is happening in all or even necessarily most international adoptions, just that when it happens, it's quite horrible to the families who've had to lose their children.
You've cited the story of a woman named Lauren Galindo as someone who's earned nearly $5 million through her participation in this industry. $5 million? How long did it take her to earn that? And what did she do?
I thought it was more than that. She forfeited a $1.4 million home and her Jaguar after her conviction or after her sentencing plea bargain. that didn't take her that long. People showed up in Cambodia and handed her money in cash, and they were called mandatory humanitarian donations for the orphanage. The orphanage remained a dump, a stash house. The immigrations investigator called it worse. It would have been shut down by the ASPCA if dogs had been there and if it had been here. She just took the money and took it home and bought herself a big house in Hawaii. That was a few years ago. When was her prosecution? 2004. It wouldn't have taken her long. And the fees have gone up dramatically since then. She was doing adoptions for just $8,500 or $11,000.
Are there other people like Lauren Galindo, or is she a rarity?
She's a
rarity. I'm talking about being prosecuted and getting caught.
She got caught. Generally, it is hard to prosecute these people. They don't work so openly, or they're not American nationals, or there's many barriers to actually shutting these things down. The biggest one has been that there has been no national regulation. Adoption agencies, for the most part, are overseen by state agencies, and they're overseen as if they were charities, as if they were still Catholic social services trying to place children for unwed teenagers. When it's become quite profitable and tens of thousands of dollars change hands in the course of an international adoption, and how could Florida Department of Social Services, that's not the exact word, but whatever their equivalent is, how can they oversee an Ethiopian adoption? They can't. It's just inadequate. So in April 2008, the United States finally implemented the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption, which was passed and signed, international treaty passed and signed in 1993. The big hole in the Hague Convention, the big plus, is that agencies have to get some kind of accreditation license to do international adoptions, American agencies. But the hole is that they only have to get accreditation to work in other countries that have signed the Hague Treaty. So agencies that want to work in Nepal or Ethiopia or Russia, for that matter, they have no oversight except the Better Business Bureau and whatever Wyoming Department of Social Services, wherever they're licensed, wherever they're based.
Now, these children are likely to have much better lives than in their adopted situation than they would have if they had stayed with their families. But do you see any parallels to the sex slave industry?
That's a very provocative question. For the most part, they are going to have materially easier lives. I am not sure that I would want to play God and say this child is going to be better off with a richer family than with its original family. And one of the children who had been trafficked by Lauren Galindo out of Cambodia, when her operation got greedier in its later years, they started taking not just infants and toddlers, but older children. And this child, originally named Song Ki, had a family, was living with her sister after her mother died, was living with her sister, brother-in-law, helping raise her nephew right down the street from her beloved aunts and cousins, and was taken into adoption and sent to an American family, Judith Mosley and her family, who believed they were doing a humanitarian thing by taking in an older child who's less likely to get adopted. Although it turned out Cameron, Song Ki, she was renamed Cameron, had been stolen to order, essentially. And she testified in Lauren Galindo's trial that she may not have had a big car, but she had a family who loved her. It was very moving testimony. We've posted that on our website. She's now applying for colleges. You can't say her life is terrible. It's not that she's been shipped off to become a prostitute, but it's still wrong.
Is there a country that has reliable humane policies for offering children to foreign families?
There are some countries, I have been told, and I did the research into the really bad countries more than I did into the good countries. But I have been told that some countries have very careful centralized oversight to make sure that the only children referred for international adoption really have no other option. They don't have extended family who would care for them. Their birth family wouldn't be able to keep them if they had a little bit of social assistance.
Now, a listener writes in, I have visited several Russian baby homes or orphanages, which are dismal. Do you object to adopting these children, too?
I have no objection to it. I have no objection to international adoption. I only have objections to babies being bought and sold as if they were commodities. There are definitely children in desperate need of homes. Those tend to be the older and institutionalized children. The Eastern European Bloc countries, there are a lot of children in institutions who need homes. They have a harder time finding homes because they are not those blank slate baby, healthy babies that most people are in line for. But God knows anyone who wants to bring in some of those institutionalized children, you are doing the Lord's work.
Is there an organization that's responsible for policing the buying and selling of children?
There is not.
So there's no way to really crack down on the practice?
The Hague Convention on International Adoption, intercountry adoption, as they say in other countries, if implemented more strictly, could give the United States an opportunity to shut down agencies that work with, that end up in trouble, end up involved with unscrupulous actors overseas. Right now, if I were to go into international adoption, I would only work through an agency that had been accredited by the State Department, and those are listed on the State Department as Hague-accredited agencies.
E.J. Graff's study, Babies in Need of Adoption, The Lie We Love, has been our subject of discussion. She's Associate Director and Senior Researcher at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.